Welcome to the Emotional Balance Sheet, the go-to podcast for parents with multiple kids, especially those with twins, triplets, or more, who are navigating the maze of modern family life and personal finance. Whether you're overwhelmed by education or retirement planning, parenting dilemmas, career transitions, or trying to define your purpose and plan, we're here to guide you with empathy, encouragement, and expertise. Hosted by Paul Fenner, founder of Tama Capital, a certified financial planner and parent to four kids, including a set of triplets. Our podcast is your ally in the quest for financial peace of mind, proving that money matters, but family comes first. Subscribe now and join our community of empowered parents at tamacapital.com. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for investment decisions. Clients of Tama may retain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
What does mainstream media get wrong in their economic and stock market coverage? How much does the economy actually influence the stock market, or vice versa? Neil Dutta, a noted business economist from Renaissance Macro Research and father of One Plus Twins, takes us on a journey into investment advice's economics and shattering some stereotypes mainstream media continually dishes out. Neil will debunk the myth of the doomer in investment circles, and he also offers a fresh perspective on current economic conditions, including inflation and the labor market. My conversation goal with Neil is to help you not accept what economic headlines you read or hear. Our economy is a complex organism that cannot be explained in a two-minute segment. This is why I rely on experts like Neil, who can help me dig deeper and provide meaningful information to you and the families I work with. Please enjoy my conversation with Neil Dutta. So Neil, we're gonna cover a lot today. We're going to talk about the economy, and we're going to talk about a Disney cruise, and we're probably going to talk about what we just did before we hit record, was how your twins are somewhat sick right now. So all that's going to resonate with the audience, I think, pretty well. So, but before we get started, I have to deliver a message from Madison, who's my girl triplet. We didn't meet on the cruise because she was off doing whatever the kids were doing. She said, tell Mr. Dutta that I agree. I could not wait to get off of that ship.
Oh, I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, people have been asking me a lot about the Disney cruise. I mean, you know, I think it's one of these things where it's sort of better in theory than it is in practice, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's an overwhelming kind of experience just being on there. But yeah, I wasn't a fan. I think we'll take the kids to the parks next time. I mean, for us, I mean, my kids are quite young. So I have twin boy, girl, and they're five. And my oldest is going to be eight in May.
Okay.
And so my wife and I were basically thinking, let's do the cruise because, you know, a full day in the Disney parks in Orlando is
it's brutal.
Lot. I mean, for a five-year-old, it's a lot. And
especially if you go with my wife, Teresa.
Well, I mean, right. See, if you're doing all the rides, I mean, it's an exhausting day, even for an adult. So for them, it's got to be crazy. And so, we sort of tested the waters earlier in the year where we kind of just, let's take them to like, because normally we just go to beach vacations, right? We just get down to a resort, take them, let them go do their thing. And, you know, and it's sort of, everything's sort of very contained. And so we took them to DC this fall and like give them like an initial taste of, you know, what a city sort of walking type of experience would be. And it was nonstop, like, I don't want to walk there. My legs hurt, this, that, you know, the older one is fine, but the twins just weren't there yet. So we said, okay, we'll go do the cruise. And the cruise is also like pretty, I mean, it's, yeah, yes, you're on a boat, but it's a pretty overwhelming kind of thing. I mean, getting on, getting off, waiting on lines for everything. I mean, it's very, very, yeah, I wasn't a fan.
But yeah, I will, not to burst your bubble. So I know that Teresa, my wife, will listen to this show because I already primed her that, hey, you know that guy I was talking to in front of us during the show? Like, I know him. Like, he was on Josh and Mike's show, you know, back in, I think it was January when you were on the Compounded Friends. And she's like, I cannot believe you met him. I'm like, well, that's probably the best part of the whole trip because we ended up getting sick. And I was so afraid. And I was starting to get sick that day. And I know we shook hands a few times. I'm like, I told Teresa, I'm like, I pray to God I did not get Neil sick.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I think anyone that wants to go on a cruise should go in thinking they're going to get sick coming out. I mean, there's a reason why those boats were sort of left on the docks for weeks during the middle of COVID, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, those things are just sort of, you know, germ infesting dens. And yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I think for us, I mean, we probably won't do it again, but hey,
well, I'll say
it's not like me saying don't go on one's going to stop people from not going,
right.
from going. So, you know, I think Disney's fine.
Yeah, I think Disney will be fine too. Bob's got the ship going in some direction. But I will say that, and Teresa will, you know, not take kind of these words. I think that the cruise is a much scaled down version of the parks. So if you thought that cruise was bad, Neil, that the parks are going to be pretty tough.
No, I mean, to me, it's like at least you're outside and it's like open. I mean, the most
just
fun
don't
I
go
had
in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, the most fun I had was the 2 days we got off the boat.
Oh, yeah. That was a nice, I think, for me, the two great things about the trip was, now my kids are older, so I have, you know, 13-year-old triplets, and then my plus one's 11. So I think first thing is Disney did a great job with, like, their clubs, like their teen clubs, because there would be, like, large portions of the day, like, we wouldn't see our kids at all. And then I thought that the Castaway Key, their private beach or whatever island, I thought that was great. Like, we didn't get off at the Bahamas because it was like, I wasn't feeling that great. And Teresa's like, you know, she had read things about not being very safe. She's like, none of us are getting off this boat. But the Castaway Key was really nice.
Yeah. I mean, we got off at all of the, we're just itching to get off the boat. So we did go out to Nassau. And we went to, like, there was like a fort that they took us to. I mean, it was all pretty contained. I didn't feel unsafe. You know, obviously, like, the dock itself, like where the ship docks, I mean, that whole area is like very much built up for tourists. So it's
right.
I thought Castaway Cay was great because, I mean, just getting off the boat, I mean, the weather could have been a little bit warmer, but that's sort of the, you know, you roll the dice when you go down to the Bahamas in the wintertime because it could be very warm or it could be a little bit cooler. So, you know, but it was fine. I mean, definitely a welcome change from the weather in New York. That's for
sure. I was going to say, just for the audience, you know, let you know, like most everybody should know by now, I'm based in Metro Detroit and you're in New York. So getting away in the middle of February is good. And I was talking to the cruise director, Peter. He said, you guys are actually lucked out because this is the best weather we've had in the last couple of trips because it's been A, cooler, and then B, a lot of rain. So,
yeah, no, but, I remember the day we got there, it was just terrible.
So we've checked the box on Disney. So I wanted to make sure that Madison got her shout out because I was, she's actually a big fan of Josh and Mike's. She will actually listen to their podcast on a Saturday morning when we're driving to a swim meet. And those two guys, I've gotten to know them a little bit. You know, they were nice enough and they sent both girls some stocking caps for the cold winters up here in Michigan. So.
No, that's great. I mean, what they built over there. And of course, I mean, I know Barry Ritholtz as well from Bloomberg. I did his podcast as well. So, I mean, they built a really interesting kind of enterprise. You know, it's a wealth management company. It's a financial media company. It's both. I mean, it's a really interesting kind of fusion that they found. They're doing a great job. And one of the things I like about both Michael and Josh is just really how they, you know, they kind of focus on the big picture and what's important in the markets. And they understand, you know, that it's not really about necessarily trying to catch every downdraft in markets, but just staying invested and executing on a plan. And I like that about them.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing is people still think that there's a lot of competition within the registered investment advisor space, which is where I really fall with my family office at Tama. But that whole Ritholtz group, they do a lot for the industry for, you know, smaller you know, advisors, family offices like myself, as far as bringing in, you know, content and helping to drive, you know, change within the industry, because there's still parts of it that, you know, we fight every day, these stereotypes that are out there, because, you know, they're always going to be plenty of Bernie Madoffs out there. And, you know, we still fight that, you know, pretty much every day, some of those stereotypes. So,
right.
So your day job, rather than being on a Disney cruise ship, is you're an economist. And in some of the interviews that I've heard you talk about, it's like, sometimes when that gets brought up, you kind of like have this, correct me if I'm wrong, this like kind of cringe feeling, like, because you're a different, like, I see your work and I see you as a different kind of economist. And I think you've kind of explained it, like, you're a, and I forget how you say this, I should just let you talk about it, but you're a pragmatic economist. You're not,
well,
like,
I think I'm pragmatic, but I think the technical definition is business economist,
yes,
market economist, right? I mean, I don't like to refer to myself as an economist. I mean, I think I do that only as it's really just a function of legacy, right? I mean, I sat in a economics team when I first started my career, and that's why I think I use the title head of economic research, economist. But to me, that's kind of doing a disservice to a lot of the real economists that are out there. You know, they've studied for years, they got PhDs, they're experts in specific areas of the economic space. I mean, obviously, there's much more to economics than just business, you know, financial sector macro, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all sorts of different applications of economics as a tool, right? I mean, you know, so I don't consider myself an academic economist. Obviously, I don't have a PhD, right? Most of my experience, you know, outside of my graduate coursework is really just applied, right? Applied economics, you could say, or as I call it, business economics, right? Most of my experience is on Wall Street. So I started off at Merrill Lynch in their economics team. And I did that for about 7 or 8 years. And then I joined a smaller outfit, basically a small sort of sell-side research boutique that specializes purely in macroeconomic research. So that includes economics, or macro research, rather. That includes economics. We have someone that sort of scans the scene for us in D.C., kind of what's the interesting legislation making its way through the halls of Congress. We have someone that covers the technical piece of it for us. And so those are the sort of three core macro verticals when you think about investing. And so that's where I've been. It's called Renaissance Macro Research. I've been there, you know, really since its inception back in 2011. But, you know, so most of my experience, all of my experience has been on the sell side. But
Can you explain that for like the lay audience, if you will? Like, what does that mean, like sell side? Like, I know what it means, but I think some of our audience would not know what that is.
So to me, when you think about sell side, you're thinking about like the big broker dealers, right? Like Merrill, I mean, I say Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, or Goldman Sachs, right? I mean, these folks are basically, essentially, think of it, they're selling research and other financial products to people like you, mm-hmm. buy side investors, right? So like an RIA, that would be an example of someone on the buy side. Goldman Sachs, that would be an example of someone on the sell side. So we're a sell side research provider. We basically are trying to be core kind of macro input into the investment process of all sorts of different buy-side investors, whether that's multi-asset strategy funds, pensions, RIAs, doing more of that, even high net worth individuals. You know, we have specialty products for them as well. So, you know, sort of like, you know, long short kind of equities, right? So that's what we do. And again, and one of the things I tell people is that people that pay us for our research, they're not necessarily paying you for your call, right? Like, so for example, if I say something, I think there's something optimistic about housing, right? I mean, there's not a lot of inventory. Therefore, you know, builders can kind of gain market share because there's no resale inventory. That should be good for home building stocks. You can make that case, but that doesn't necessarily mean that someone's going to go out there and go buy housing stocks, right? I mean, so right. It's really, you're, investing is a process. And I think for the best people, it's more of a marathon than a sprint. And so I think what most people use us for is really just trying to be an input into their investment process, just to make sure that they're, you know, kind of market to marking their marking to market their kind of downside potential risk scenarios, making sure they're positioned well for potential upside risk scenarios, right? It's really, they're paying you for your thought process more so than your calls. So I think that that's also important for people to understand.
Yeah, I think that was a great way to explain it.
What does comprehensive financial planning even mean? At Tama Capital, it means a family office where lifestyle planning such as retirement, college, portfolio management, and tax prep and planning are all under one umbrella. But it goes beyond numbers. We focus as much on the emotional side of financial planning as we do on the financial side. We get you. We understand your challenges of building a family, business or career, and a healthy life. We are devoted to wealth planning for families like yours because we are you. Learn how our family can help your family by visiting tamacapital.com.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on is the families that I work with, they typically get their economic information from two sources. One, me, but actually more so mainstream media. And sometimes that makes me kind of cringe. And so one of the bigger questions I wanted to lead off with you is when somebody, average American, is looking at, you know, mainstream media, like the, you know, major news at 6:30, or maybe they flip on CNBC or Bloomberg or some, you know, a channel like that, is what is the mainstream media getting wrong that the average American would pick up on and not quite be sure that, well, how does that even make sense?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, the first is at the 6:30 nightly news, you always get a rundown about what did the Dow Jones do today? What did the S&P do today? What did the NASDAQ do today? And if you listen to that and nothing else about their economic coverage, you're probably doing yourself, in my view, a service. Because just reading those numbers, I think, is enough to, I mean, that's how most people kind of interpret economic information. It sounds very simplistic, but, and obviously politicians hate it when, well, you don't think the stock market is the best gauge of the economy. Well, actually, it is. And so, and there's a reason why they don't quote bond markets, right? I mean, it's not like they're telling you what the 10-year yield is doing at the 6:30 nightly news.
I've never had a client ask me about bond yields.
Right. So the stock market is the primary way that people kind of process economic information, more or less. I mean, obviously, gas prices have an important effect, too. But I think it's important. I think the stock markets are an important signal. And that's why they're a very useful input when you think about things like consumer confidence indicators, right? I mean, the stock market weighs heavily on that. So that's where I think, I mean, that's just like telling people about the weather, right? I mean, this is what it is, right? You're just reporting a fact at that point. And up is good and down is bad. And I think everyone understands that. I think where the media goes sort of awry with their is on their coverage on other things beyond that, right? Because doom sells. Okay. You know, it's just like the classic example of airplanes, right? I mean, airplanes are the safest way to travel, but if there was a crash, it would be nonstop in the news, right? Netflix did a whole documentary on the MH370. I mean, it's very interesting stuff when unexpected events happen. And, you know, and that's also kind of reflected, frankly, in the research voices that you hear in the sell side, too. I mean, like I said, doom sells. You know, remember, it's important for people to understand that the negative case sounds smart.
Smart. Yeah.
Negative case always sounds very smart. It's the one that'll get you the biggest crowd at the cocktail party, you know, but it's not. But it's usually wrong. Right. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, society has a way of figuring things out. And so, you know, in my career, I've generally kind of erred on the side of optimism. I mean, I'm kind of known for that. I mean, there was a brief period maybe in in the middle of 2022, where I was actually cautious because I thought the Fed was going to kind of engineer a recession. But beyond that, I mean, you know, generally speaking, doom sells. And a lot of people in the kind of newsletter subscription business understand that. That's what they sell. Understand that. And it's important to kind of understand that's not really going to help you make much money. It's one of these things where it's a huge windfall for them if they're right, right? I mean, so in other words, right, you could be like a doomer, in other words, and be wrong, and then spectacularly right. And then people remember you for being right at that time when, you know, and we know all the names. I mean, those people have been trading off being right one time in 2008, and it's, you know, 15 years later, and we're still, and that's why they have their entire notoriety, right? But one of the points I made on Josh's podcast too was, look, I think for me, like, it's much more important just to be right about a lot of little things than right about one big thing, because people right about one very big thing are usually wrong about most everything else. And so, and I think that's worth just sort of acknowledging. And you know, in our business, it's really about just kind of picking your spots, right? I mean, everyone always wants to kind of dunk on the consensus. The consensus is always, you know, be contrarian investors. But in reality, the consensus is usually more right than wrong. That's the wisdom of crowds. So one of the things I learned very early on is that when you pick your battles, it's important to pick them wisely, right? Like, what do you think that's very important that no one's really talking about? And is that important enough to kind of challenge the consensus, right? And so that's when you pick your spots, but you don't do it just for the sake of doing it. And I think there's a lot of that, frankly, out there right now.
Yeah, that's where I've had to really face my own cognitive biases over the last, you know, I'm 48 this year. I'll be 48 in May. I started investing when I was 13, but yeah, I've had my firm for about, 13 years now, and I've been doing it a lot longer than that, but it's trying to become more optimistic. And I think that's one of the things I love about following your work, Tom Lee's work, Brian Belsky's work, is like your guys' work helps drown out that negativity. Because I don't know, you probably know the stat at the top of your head, like 80% of the market is, you know, if you look at it on an annual basis, the market's up usually 8 out of 10 times, you know, over a year. And so it's, you know, going back to what you just pointed out, it's like the doomers, if you will, they get that call once right, and then everybody jumps on their bandwagon, and it's usually pretty freaking fleeting.
Yeah, that's my thinking. I mean, like I said, I mean, it's, and again, I mean, it's very difficult to make money on it, right? I mean, because it's like a perfect kind of setup for them, right? Because they can just keep pitching the doom. And, you know, I mean, even in an uptake, utility stocks and staples are going to go up, right? I mean,
right.
Maybe they're underperforming other areas of the market, but, you know, a lot of people, so long as their portfolio is going up in price and up in value, they're not going to really care. And, you know, on the way down, obviously you'll be more protected, right? I mean, if you're basically in defensive areas of the equity market. But, you know, to me, it's important to catch more of the upside in a bull market. And I think that, to me, is where the doom case kind of goes awry, right? I mean, right? Like you can protect someone on the way down, but are you going to get them everything that you should on the way up?
So to go a little deeper on a specific topic that I think is still hot right now, it's still a topic that a lot of families I work with are asking me, and just, you know, general public, if you will, is inflation. And the commentary that I'm getting is that inflation, higher prices are still an issue for most people. And maybe it's just the sphere that I live and breathe and work in, is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, have kids that are going to college. College costs aren't coming down. Healthcare costs aren't coming down. But they see, again, going back to like some mainstream media, and even in the data that I've shown, is that inflation is slowing down. But I think that there's this mismatch in conception, if you will, where, you know, an apple that cost $1 3 years ago, still it costs $2 today. And while that increase has slowed down, the fact is that apple is still a lot more expensive than it was 3 years ago. And I think that's what people are having a hard time wrapping their arms or head around about when it comes to inflation. Can you explain this for us at all, or kind of point us to where the data really is showing that yes, inflation is getting better, but
well, I think it's one of these things where there's a difference between, and there's two ways to look at a piece of economic data generally. Okay. This simplifies it, but I think this helps answer your question. You can look at things in level terms, or you can look at things in momentum terms, right? Like rate of change. So something like a momentum indicator would be the change in jobs month to month. A level indicator would be something like the unemployment rate. And if you apply this to inflation, like something like the price level versus how much it's grown over the last 6 months, right? And I think that's what's driving, you know, the disconnect between maybe what some economists are saying about inflation versus what people are still feeling, right? I mean, it takes a bit of time for people to kind of reset and, you know, notice the improvement in anything, whether that's inflation or just a general economy, right? I mean, it takes time for that, for what's in the statistics for that to be ingrained in people's minds. And so I think that that's part of the reason why inflation, you know, is still kind of front and center and for, you know, a lot of surveys of households and consumers in terms of something that's very important. Of course, the other reason is, what drives, I mean, economists care about inflation expectations because that's thought to lead actual inflation, right? Actual inflation is driven in large part by expected inflation. And for households, a lot of what drives their expected inflation are the things that they spend a lot, they spend on frequently. Gas, food, maybe rent, right? So that's another reason why, you know, perceptions have been a little bit worse than some of the data itself. Now, that being said, I do think that over the next year or so, you will continue to see people feeling a little bit better about the economy and inflation in particular. You know, when I look at the inflation data, I mentioned momentum. Well, over the last 6 months, you know, inflation has more or less been at 2%. Right. So
right.
January was a weak month, or rather January was a setback for inflation. It unexpectedly rose. But in the 6 months before that, it was generally coming in, you know, lower than expectation, which is a good thing. So to me, it's really just time. You know, Nate Silver did some interesting work where he basically made the point that it takes about 2 years of lower inflation for that to actually show up in consumer attitudes. Right. I think he said something like the 2 year rate of change is what really matters for sentiment. And so if that's the standard, then, you know, by the end of this year, you should start to see it show up a little bit more. I mean, barring some kind of upside inflation shock, you should start to see it show up more in, you know, in how people are feeling about things. And I think what's important, of course, is that inflation has moderated to an extent that now people are beginning to see real growth in incomes again. I mean, that was a big, you know, problem in 2022 and parts of 2023, but now it's less so. I mean, if you look at real incomes, excluding government transfers like Social Security, you know, that's up at a reasonably solid pace over the last 3 to 6 months. And so that's encouraging. I mean, it certainly mitigates the risk of recession. It keeps consumer spending growing. So, you know, but to me, it's really just time. I mean, and the history is littered with examples like this, right? Where, you know, for example, in 1992, then President George H.W. Bush, you know, I mean, the economy actually grew like almost 4% that year, but it wasn't until the year after that people really started to feel it. So the election was kind of poorly timed,
right?
You know, from this perspective. So it's, again, it's not unusual to see examples like this, throughout history.
I think one of the aspects of this too, it kind of goes back to the practical, the business nature of the business economy that, that you have talked about is that the labor market is still extremely strong, which for a lot of people is still like, you're still scratching your head on that one, but it is what it is. And it coincides with what you just mentioned too, with there's been a steady, you know, increase in wages. So I don't think it should come as a surprise, even though it does, to people that are getting on airplanes and going on trips or going out, you know, to eat on a more frequent basis, that, you know, things in those areas, in the service economy, if you will, are still costing more, because that's where largely a lot of the demand is. And just like we saw that spike in demand for material things early on in COVID, and then it basically flip-flopped as we moved out of it, I think that is still like a telling sign to people, like, well, when I go out to my favorite restaurant, you know, I'm spending, you know, $5 or $10, you know, more, or $20 more, you know, every time I go out.
Yeah, no, I mean, the pre-pandemic economy is still kind of fresh in a lot of people's minds. And so, you know, people, I mean, that's why they're reacting the way they are. Now, like anything, the further you're removed from the shock, the less you feel it, right? I mean, as an example, look at the housing market, right? I mean, the initial run up to 7% mortgage rates really depressed housing market activity. But what do we see now? People are adjusting. You know, sellers that were kind of, you know, on the fence are just, you know, sort of biting the bullet and letting some inventory out on the market. You know, buyers are, you know, not really waiting around and as much as they had been before for lower rates, which is why whenever you get even a modest decline in rates, you get this big pickup in mortgage demand, which just, again, tells you that people are getting used to the interest rate environment out there. And I think that'll be the case with prices as well, right? I mean, so, with, you know, again, like taking it back to mortgage rates, it's one thing to go from, you know, 3% to 7%. It's quite another, or 3% to 6.5%. It's quite another go from 6.5% to 7%. Doesn't sting as much the second time. And that's the same thing for prices. I mean, yes, you know, inflation was a big shock when it first happened, but now we're growing, you know, sort of more in line with what we have seen historically. And so if that continues, that should kind of mitigate some of the pressure that people feel, at least when they're surveyed on the inflation side.
Going back to labor for a second, because I think that's one of the, you know, personally, the biggest drivers. I mean, obviously, if people have jobs, they're going to spend. 70% of our economy is consumer driven. So what does cracks in the labor market, like, when do those start to appear? Is it like looking at the initial unemployment claims on a weekly basis? Is it the jobs numbers that come out every month that can have wild adjustments? Like, what should we be looking at to the labor market to say, yep, things are continuing to go good, or wait a minute, we're starting to see some bad prints, if you will, and maybe this thing is starting to show some cracks or slowing down?
I mean, from my own perch, I think the monthly jobs numbers are the most important piece of labor market data that are released every month. I mean, there's a wealth of information coming out from the statistical agencies like the Labor Department and so forth. Like the BLS releases a lot of important employment numbers, but the most important one is the employment situation report, you know, payrolls, the unemployment rate that comes out on the first Friday of every month, typically. And I think that's the most useful information. Claims are good. They're high frequency. They come out every week. It's a good thing to look at, but that only really gives you one side of the equation. It's just telling you about how many people are fired, how many people are, you know, kind of rolling in to, unemployment, right? So they're unable to find jobs as rapidly, but it doesn't really tell you much about the hiring rate. And I also think it kind of loses some of its utility once the monthly jobs number comes out, right? Like, so if initial claims went up in 1 month, but the jobs data that month were fine, then, you know, like, it's not that important that claims were up, right? So I do think that the monthly jobs number is the most important, more important thing. And that's obviously reflected in the markets, because when do markets move the most? It's typically on non-farm Fridays.
Right. One, to go back to one of the things that we had poked on was you know, when people are looking at, you know, mainstream media, the 6:30 national news, and getting an update on, you know, what the market did that day, you know, how is it the market that's leading the economy, or is it vice versa? And did the two ever come unhinged? So, like, you know, in 2022, the market was, you know, pretty much a disaster, but yet the economy was, you know, pretty solid. So how do you square that circle, if you will?
Well, I mean, I think generally, I mean, so one of the things I like to say, I mean, you hear a lot of people say the stock market is not the economy.
Right.
Which is true, but it's, that doesn't necessarily, but at the same time, the stock market's not the economy. Right? I mean, do you see what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, all you have to do is pull up a chart of like real GDP and the year-over-year performance of the S&P 500 and see the relationship. I mean, there's clearly, you know, a link there. Right. I mean, so I do think that stocks are leading indicators of the economy, generally speaking. There are times when they're disconnected and, you know, for whatever reason. And, you know, usually when that happens, you know, ultimately a refocusing back on the fundamentals, good economic news can kind of help kind of the equity markets find their footing. You know, 2022 was an interesting case because obviously, you know, the performance of the equity market over a long period of time is basically going to be a function of earnings, right? But
right.
If you look at it on a shorter horizon, right? I mean, stocks are a function of essentially three things, right? It's earnings, actual and projected earnings, the risk-free rate, and then you know, like treasury yields, and then the equity risk premium, sort of the expected performance of bonds against stocks, right? And so 2022 was, you know, I mean, we basically had, I mean, a lot of the weakness in equities was driven by higher interest rates, right? All else equal, rapid increase in rates is going to weigh on equities. And that's what happened, right? So, and so, you know, you could say then with inflation running above the Fed's goal, a strong economy wouldn't necessarily be the best thing for stocks because it would mean much higher interest rates as a result.
So when I get asked about, well, I always get asked, like, what's your take on the economy? And my pretty much resonant answer is, I don't know. Like, I'm not in the prediction business. I don't have any insight on to where the market's going, the stock market, the economy. I look at all the data as much as possible, a lot of the data, which you cover in a lot of detail. When you're asked that, like you mentioned earlier that your guys' perspective is to try to get a lot of the little things right rather than like trying to do a big market time. Is that what people should be focused on, is not necessarily trying to forecast like where things are going? Because
I think one of the things that people do in my business is, or in economics, business economics, is, you know, you're trying to kind of, I mean, most of the job is just trying to tell people the sort of lights on, lights off, right? Are we in expansion or recession? I think that's a lot of it. But I think that's important, right? Like just understanding when, you know, the economy is growing and when it's not. And so I think that's important because you've had so many people kind of come out and say, we're in a rolling recession, we're, you know, it's, I mean, but to me, really, all of these things are just kind of euphemisms for we're not in a recession yet. Right. I mean, so to me, I think that's probably the most important thing. The other thing I would say is that to me, it's not immediately clear to me that you need to be necessarily right about the next 12 months. It's very important to be right about what's happening right now. Right. I mean, so in some respects, your nowcast is just as important as your forecast.
That's interesting. I never thought about that way.
Because if you aren't even right about what's happening at the moment, how are you going to have a chance about what, I mean, right? Like what's going to happen 12 months from now, right? I mean, so, and that to me was the big problem in 2023, right? I mean, everyone was kind of forecasting this recession.
Right.
Even though there was no evidence in the data itself as it was coming out that there was going to, that we were in, right? And so I think having a good nowcast, I mean, because you're not going to necessarily beat the market on the forecast, right? I mean, it's you know, who knows whether the markets are even looking that far ahead, right? But if you have a good kind of sober view of what current conditions look like, I think that's probably a very good starting point to doing well in a seat like the one I'm in.
So can you walk us through, how did you get into economics? Like, I wanted to kind of dive into your background for these last couple of questions, but how did you even get into economics? Like, what was the interest there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think obviously when you're in college, you don't even know jobs like this exist, right?
Right.
I did study economics in college, but believe it or not, you know, my initial role at Merrill Lynch, I was actually a compensation analyst. So I was sort of scrambling at the end of, you know, when I graduated NYU, I was kind of scrambling for something because I took my LSAT. I didn't do well enough to go to a school I would have wanted to for law school. So I was like, you know, I might as well just, I'm in the city. I have a passion for finance. It's New York. I should go into finance. So my first goal, frankly, was just let me get into anything. Any bulge bracket firm that'll hire me, I'm going to apply. I'm going to get in and let's see. And then, you know, so I applied to Merrill and I, you know, by that point, all the investment banking people had already gotten their jobs, you know, and so I was sort of, you know, so I took this job as a compensation analyst. I did that for about a year. The good thing about being in HR at a big company like that is that you kind of know where all the jobs are. And so there was an opening on the economic research team. It was headed by David Rosenberg. And so I joined his team basically a year after joining Merrill Lynch. And so that's kind of how I got my start. I mean, I was doing a lot of like kind of the back end work. I mean, I wasn't writing or making views. I was basically doing most of my work was in support of his views, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so, but you know, helping him. But you get a flavor for what the job is, right? I mean, marketing to clients, writing research.
And Rosie, he was a marketing machine.
Yes, he is. He was and is. And I mean, yeah. That's sort of one aspect of the job. And then, you know, after Rosenberg left, Ethan Harris joined from Lehman Barclays. And then I worked with him for several years as well. So my time at Merrill was basically equally split between these two chief economists. And, you know, Ethan, you know, to me, he's an economist, right? Not only does he have a PhD, but he's also like a very... you know, he's very market savvy. So he's both an academic and a business economist, in my view. And, you know, where Rosie kind of taught a lot of the marketing aspect of the role, like, you know, I mean, people, it's like any other business. You pay for people you like. And I think Rosie understood that. And, you know, in Ethan's case, he did the marketing, but his passion was actually like writing good research, having good, you know, sort of, you know, like a very cogent, logical case. And he's the one who kind of taught me this whole notion of, you know, you have to pick your battles wisely. You can't always just light your hair on fire to get, you know, to be heard. I mean, you know, sometimes it's okay if you have nothing interesting to say. I mean, that's okay. So you want to be able to pick your spots. So I really appreciated that about him. So I kind of had it, my upbringing in the business came from these two kind of perspective. So I think it helps kind of round me out a little bit. And that's how I got my start. And, you know, and Merrill Lynch, obviously, Merrill was a huge equity shop, you know, and Ethan obviously came from a bond market shop, Lehman. I cared a lot more about the Fed, fixed income than I did anything. So one of the things I would spend a lot of my time on when I was like sort of a more mid-level economist at Merrill was just kind of, you know, taking our economics calls and making them useful for an equity markets audience. You know, what sectors do we think are doing better? What, you know, how do we think the recovery in the market's going to drive, you know, spending differentials among different kind of income cohorts, you know? And obviously Merrill has a huge, you know, sort of equity research platform, right? And so one of the things I would do a lot is kind of write economic research and then bring in the analysts that covered these specific areas. And so for an equity salesperson, that's like a home run, right? If you have a macro story and then you can marry it to a specific stock market call, then it's a very easy pitch. And so That's what I focused a lot of my time on towards the tail end of my time at Merrill.
Well, that I really appreciate that insight, because I know that I've got a couple of my kids, my family office kids that are trying to figure out like what they're going to do when they hit college this year. And I know a few of them already, freshman, sophomore. So I think I'll be able to pass this along and say, hey, look, if you're interested in this, this is some really good advice. So
the most important thing is just getting your foot in the door.
Yeah.
It's luck. I mean, there's a lot of things that get, but I think getting your foot, because there's so many different asset classes, right? I mean, you can, and like macro, I mean, yes, you go to school for economics, but macro and macro strategy, I mean, these are things you kind of pick up over time, right?
Right.
I think that's why it's important to kind of get your just foot in the door. And, there are so many different asset classes that apply macro thinking, obviously FX, right? I mean, central bank rate differentials. I mean, that's a huge driver of what goes on in the foreign exchange markets, right? So, obviously corporate credit, right? I mean, sometimes, maybe you don't get into macro right away, but you can get into an asset class. And sometimes, I mean, in some cases, that could actually be better. And you can kind of use that to build your sort of macro chops.
I think that's great advice. And I'm sure these kids are going to appreciate that. So I'll get to my closing question, because I only have you for a little bit more time. Is, as we kind of let off the show, by now people know that you have a set of twins and you have one plus twins. I have triplets plus one is how I kind of explain that. But my closing question I ask all the parents is, what is the best thing about being a parent?
Well, I mean, the best thing about being a parent is just seeing them kind of go through life milestones every day. I mean, that's kind of, it's always, when they see something for the first time, it's always very interesting. And just how they process information. One of the things that, I mean, to me, it's sort of, this kind of sounds kind of cynical, but I'm just going to say it. I mean, the best thing about being a father of twins, and the worst thing is probably the days go by really quickly, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think a blessing and a curse. And, I mean, obviously when you're doing it, you just want it to be over with as quickly as possible. Like, I mean, do I want to get up and get you ready for this, that, and the other thing, take you to this thing, or, I have gymnastics, I have soccer, I have this or that. But, I think, but that's also part of the joy, right? I mean, so, it's one of the things I appreciate more so now. Obviously, with three kids, it's a lot to kind of coordinate schedules and so forth. And what I will say, though, I mean, having twins is probably easier than having two kids at a different age. That's my opinion. Because everything's sort of seamless, right? They're doing it at the same time. It's a lot of upfront cost, but there's a big payoff towards the end.
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with you, because obviously my triplets are all the same age, but my plus one Mackenzie is 11. So they're 2 years age apart, but only one grade in school. And I did an entire podcast on how the days are long, but the years are short. So I completely agree with what you're saying there. And there is such a thing as man to man versus zone defense when you end up having that third kid. That's a real deal.
I mean, I don't disagree. I mean, I think that's, I mean, it is, a, I personally, as an only child, I mean, I'm an only child myself, believe it or not. And I definitely don't think, I mean, one changes your life, but it's like orders of magnitude different,
you know?
And because, after like a year or so, I mean, they're basically integrated into your day to day. I mean, it's no big deal, but when you go from two on one to man to man and then to zone, I mean, that's a huge leap. But like I said, I mean, it's a big upfront cost, but it does get easier, I think, as they get older. So
yeah, I kind of explain it that, every year some things get easier and some things get harder. So it's like you're always in this kind of like plateau, if you will. But as Teresa has told people and kind of explaining our situation, she's very, I think, accurate in her statement where she says when they were little, it was more physical wear and tear. And now that they're older, it's now more mental wear and tear.
Yeah, it's just a different, yeah, it's just, but that's part of the evolution, right? That's part of the evolving process. I mean, yeah, you have days like today, for example, where I have my kids in the other room. You know, one of them's actually sick, one of them's pretend sick, so they both get to come home.
Yeah, I will never forget those days. Well, Neil, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. Hopefully, we'll have you back at the end of the year, and I hopefully foresee you becoming our resident economic expert on the emotional balance sheet. But I can't thank you enough, and I'd still. Teresa was like, "How excited are you about talking to Neil today?" I'm like, I can't even tell you. I'm like, it's amazing that we met on that cruise. It was just being at the right place in the right time. And
yeah,
that's one thing.
Thank God for Mickey.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank God for Mickey. It's like, but I find that within the industry and what I do specifically is the serendipitous nature of what I do and the relationships I've built and people like you that I've been able to meet and follow has just been tremendous. So can't thank you enough for taking the time, especially with what you're dealing with today with some sick kids, but I look forward to our next conversation, hopefully here later this year.
Definitely. Thanks, Paul. So great to do it with you.
Well, as you could tell by the sound of that conversation, Neil was the first podcast guest I've ever met on a cruise ship. It just reminds me of the serendipitous nature of what I do, how I work with families, and this industry in general of financial planning. So what did we learn from Neil? Well, hopefully you learned that you can't just take mainstream media headlines at their word. There's a lot more that goes in depth into how our economy works, especially when it comes to sentiment, how we can feel terrible about the economy, but yet the data says something else, or vice versa. The data says things are terrible, but yet we feel great. The stock market works very similarly, I think. But hopefully you could learn firsthand from an expert like Neil that you need to go deeper. And that's one of the joys that I hope that you feel I bring with this podcast and these types of interviews is to have people on like Neil that are experts in their field that could go a little bit deeper and provide some clarity and a different view than what you may just peel off the evening news or the local newspaper. Now that you've made it to the end of another great conversation, are you looking for more? If so, head over to tamacapital.com, where you will find all of our conversations. Use the search feature to find the topic or guest you would love to learn more about. Also, don't forget to make someone else's day by sharing our show. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. That's all for this week. We'll see you next time.